This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The conversation is set up, it's the sort of discourse of the master. You know, the protocols are academic protocols, the younger man respectfully querying the older, slightly older man, the expert about negativity and at the academic discourse, and there's something ludic or transgressive about the visuals that erupts from within that discourse of the master.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's all to the good in the sense of breaking that. I mean, Jarni certainly is not someone who has a kind of student relation to, the teacher's master or his, although it may sound that way in this, but he's extremely, he's very extreme and very irreverent. Before we had the conversation, he submitted 50 or 60 questions and asked me to just, could I suggest the ones that I thought might be most useful to discuss? And so many of these questions had to do with, shooting people and sort of, and the future of gay terrorism. And there's a section in the film where he explicitly asks about what is the future of gay terrorism. And I said, well, what is the present of gay terrorism? I don't see any of it at all. So, but I like him, and I think his extravagant, sometimes sort of little simple, take on things, I found sort of tonic at the same time that, I had to write to him and say there are 4 out of the 50 questions that I think are addressable. and they were sort of mild ones, like should we go down in the street and with a gun?
So that was, but Leo, did you think that that he is being authentic in asking you this, or is this a performance on his part? I mean, I kept wondering to what extent, this was entirely a performative in which he was. I mean, the way in which the interrogation structure has been so stripped bare of anything. So that, it's just the grayness, the two of you. It's as if he wants to set this up. Mm. And I sort of want us to get to the point of sort of what that setup might be about. But did you get that feeling? Mm.
But you mean that the question, because you mentioned 2 very different things.
Yep.
One is the decor, which is extremely bare and respectable looking. I want to say something about that in a minute. But then you think the other, that his sort of extravagant questions are set up as in counterpoint to that, or?
What I'm trying to think through, I mean, there are parts of this film that made me feel like I was watching the class clown, right, in high school, who was puncturing the seriousness of the conversation with the eruption of the irreverent. And and so there's part of that, and that's easy to dismiss and rather tiresome after a while. But there's another way to frame that, which is that in so doing, he's taking the whole idea, the whole site of enunciation, of either a theoretical discourse or of the idea of mastery or any constellation of related ideas, and asking us to think through to what extent are we going to put any kind of investment into the idea of authority as queers? And that's an interesting question. Am I making sense?
Yeah. I didn't feel that the, I think I could have taken it without being destroyed by it, but I didn't feel it was being irreverent, that it was any kind of, subterranean undoing of me or of an attack on what I was saying. I always thought we get along very well, and he says these things that I find outrageous and sometimes not very bright, and I just tell him, and I feel that he's fine with all that, but But at the same time, there's a... I mean, he's somebody who's extremely... And it's sort of tonic because, again, because students usually aren't that way. I mean, they are too reverent or too... In general.
Yeah, that's
in
true.
In general. Then you often, you know, there's the other extreme that shows up every once in a while, and that makes you yearn for the return to reverence. But apart from that, he is... I think he's very angry, and angry about the issues. And I don't think he sets things up. I mean, this our conversations when we have coffee together have been much more, you know, when he's not, there's no reason for him to be insincere or holding back or anything. And he is extremely, and he reads a lot. I mean, the question sounded to me sometimes if it's someone who's never read anything. On the other hand, I discovered he had read many more of, for example, queer novels, queer theory, than I've read. And usually his reactions, at least just, you know, it's good or bad, I thought were very intelligent. Mm. So he's a strange person. But so it was interesting. I didn't know him and met him only a few months ago, actually. So.
There's also a way of reading the visual disruptions as mimetic of the transgression or negativity within your discourse. In other words, as a kind of visual correlative of your theoretical positions.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's another, frankly, less sympathetic way, which is also to see them as an eruption of the body, of the somatic, in a realm that is in some sense premised on sexuality, on relationships and all of that, but that, at least in its affect, doesn't acknowledge it. Right? So it brings the body to the fore. I mean, I loved the ejaculating on your...
Well, actually, it's interesting about the body, because I realized only after I'd seen the visuals, which Johnny had not, I mean, he didn't know what they were going to be either. But when we were preparing for this, he said, I think we should wear, I mean, this wasn't my idea, so I think we should wear suits and ties. And I sort of puzzled. And he said, I'm going to wear one of my Brioni suits. Well, I must admit, I mean, I never heard of Brioni. And sort of, and I, you know, called up somebody who knows everything about fashion, probably Kajan, and said, who is Brioni? And it turns out Brioni is the most, you know, most expensive kind of suit you can buy. Well, I didn't have one, but I had one suit, and I wore that one suit. But he came there with his Brioni, and then, you know, very cool. You noticed his sneakers and everything. So the idea was like that was set up. Certainly. I mean, here we are talking about, you know, shooting people, sex, and all this, and we're sitting there in our Brioni suit in that decor, which was Sebastian's idea that it be as simple as possible. And I thought that was sort of interesting, just the table and the bare wall and then everything else.
But it has that setting, right, has a resonance. It is in the police drama, it's where the suspect is interrogated, right, by the detective. Mm-hmm. At least did other people read it that way?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Almost.
Well, institutional in some way. I mean, it could be a classroom,
sure.
or it could be educational television. The setting, but an institutional feel to it, definitely.
Yeah.
But he didn't say, let's wear Brooks Brothers suits.
I'm sorry?
He didn't say, let's wear Brooks Brothers suits.
Oh, no, he'd never be that uncool. Sort of that. But it's, but then, and luckily it was for the next, he was very happy with the film, so he wanted to do a trilogy. And a trilogy...
I mean,
luckily not with me, but the second one was going to be with Lee Edelman, and he was thinking of the third one with Tim Dean, because he was very excited by Barebacking and Tim's book on it. Well, the second one never got done. I sort of suspected from the beginning that Lee and he were not going to hit it off.
I can see
exactly
that.
Especially since Johnny's idea was that they too should wear suits, but not sit at a table, but lie on the floor next to each other in a not having sex, but in the 69 position, and discuss that way. And I think when Lee said no, that stopped the trilogy.
I feel that somehow there was, apart from the jokes and the visual puns that he wasn't aware of, one moment when you converged, as it were, where it was when precisely you were quoting Genet, and Genet's brand of terrorism, you might say, is similar to what he seems to be advocating. Yeah. You wonder how serious Genet is in his own assertions, but at least in the U.S., it's the way he was with the Black Power militants, or in more recently in with the Palestinians,
can show
something like a political agency, whatever program. Is that something you talked about with him, with Björn?
I think he was reading so much of. I mean, and I once had a class where students only wanted to read what had been written the day before by a queer theorist. And even Genet, I couldn't get them to be interested because it was, you know,
old.
Old.
Yeah.
And which strike, you know, really depressed me very much. Sort of. But at any rate, the Genet thing was sort of interesting because, the book on the Palestinians is more direct and has more immediate political resonance. But the book that I had written on funeral rites, which is one of his most extravagant books about mourning the death of a lover who was shot during the resistance by a militiaman, that is someone who belonged to who was on the side of the Nazis. And Genet's way of mourning the death of Jean, the lover's name is Jean too, is to sort of kill him again. So he sort of reimagines the scene of Jean having been killed and sort of celebrating erotically the killer, the Nazis, and even Hitler in the book. I mean, it's in some ways, you know, sort of his most extreme work. And the work when you really have to take I admire, for example, Ed White's biography of Genet, but I think he sort of skipped over that which I find the most difficult to take in Genet, which is not obviously the homosexuality or even the theft and criminality, but the idea of betrayal, the idea of betraying a friend. And that's why I sort of provocatively began the part on Genet and homos by saying betrayal is an ethical necessity. Now, that it's sort of interesting because when students ask about that, it is this thing about language. I mean, what are you supposed to do with a sentence like that? Or what are you supposed to do with Genet's funeral rites? I mean, there's a way in which I think the work of art can have, this has interested me a lot recently, a sort of a traumatizing effect, which is not exactly, it's quite different from the effect of a message telling you what to do. I think someone like Genet, and I've also used Todd Haynes' film Safe, some of you might know that, as an example of this too, which is, you know, a woman who becomes allergic to the universe, really, in my reading of it, and therefore it's a kind of negativity without the obscenities and everything of Genet, but a negativity as total as Genet's. And, you know, people say, well, what's the use of something, of a book or of a film like that? Well, the use is precisely, I think, to sort of traumatize in some way the brain into areas that have lain dormant, mainly, and to sort of awaken neurons that haven't functioned or operated very much. And it doesn't mean that you go out and do what is literally expressed in the book. But it does mean that those extreme versions of negativity, of violence, of treachery, have sort of perhaps set off potentialities that had not been touched yet. And then it has to be translated into viability. That's a complicated obviously a complicated subject, but one that interests me very much.
Leo, you say in the film, I think the phrase is parody is a weak, what is it? A weak politics of position, which I found a particularly resonant phrase in a film like this one. I mean, it really came out in high relief. First thing I just wanted to ask, if that's a statement you hold to.
Yeah. There are two words that were a few years ago, I don't know if they still are, since I've sort of stopped reading a lot of what I suppose I should be reading. But anyway, the two words that really I found annoying were parody and subversion. Mm. I mean, they just seem to be weak. I mean, parody, of course, always includes an image of, always includes some admiration. I don't mean that it shouldn't, but I mean, what it is includes admiration for that which you're parodying, I think.
Absolutely.
And subversion, well, what is, I mean, we can all be, I mean, a lot of things are subversive, which a society, an oppressive society, tolerates subversion very well, because I think it's a rather weak, it's applied to rather weak objections to things that should be addressed more strongly.
But is there a form of resistance that doesn't necessarily acknowledge and, in some sense, right, pay tribute to that which it opposes? Isn't that the nature, right? I mean,
it pays tribute to the power of that which it opposes, or else it wouldn't, you know,
right,
have to be in the in a position of
resistance.
Resistance. Yeah. But I don't think it has to. What was the film about the drag queens who have a party every year where they, and Judith
Paris Butler, is Burning.
Paris is Burning. Yeah, and I don't know. I thought that film, it disturbed me in the sense that it was, you know, there's a lot of parody going on, but at the same time, there was sort of, I thought, sort of worship of the white, rich female society that these guys were dressing up like, and that I don't know, that bothered me, but it was.
But of course, that I think you're absolutely right. There is worship of the very society, but also a self-conscious acknowledgement that worship is ridiculous and is being undone by the very people who are doing the worshiping. So
maybe.
I see much more complexity, perhaps, in that scenario.
Yeah. That's possible. I mean, that's the best way to defend it that I've heard. But because then you go, you know, you're going one layer under it and seeing the negative aspect coming, the resistance aspect coming back.
Mm.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know.
Does the subversion come first and then the worship erodes it, or is it the other way around? You reflect inverted chronology. Do you know what I mean?
No, I'm sorry.
Leo said it seems to be subversive, but it's actually informed by worship. And then Jonathan said, yes, there is worship there, but it's undercut by subversion. And I was just struck by the fact that you had inverted Leo's formula and what the difference is between those two formulations.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems to me that, of course, there's no mode of resistance that can truly distance itself from that which it's resisting. And because inevitably the act of resistance itself mentions, right? So what you're trying to do, I mean, Ross Chambers writes about this, right? He's trying to create some sort of room so that in the mentioning of that which you're resisting, you can create various indirect modes, mostly, Chambers says, invested in the parodic and the ironic as a means of, because at least the parodic and ironic acknowledge their relationship to that which they're opposing.
Yeah. I suppose the only way to not acknowledge any relation, and even that, is sort of Johnny's solution of just shooting the people. But
that's kind of mentioning, right?
But you also have to take aim, so I guess
that's
resisting, that's acknowledging something. And sort of.
But you use the term negativity, which I found interesting in the film, as a way of not saying many other words like subversion, resistance, and so on. Where does that word come from, apart from the usual Hegelian or dialectical?
Which word?
Negativity.
Oh. Oh my God! Yeah. Well, I'm going to let you give us the Hegelian version.
I don't think I would dare start Hegelian at all.
I'm sure there are Hegelians hidden in the audience and who would rightly shoot me if I tried to. We'll have a talk
on Hegel in 2 weeks, so this is why we are.
Oh, you are? Okay, yeah. I'll come finally learn what it
is. No, but honestly, the strategy that you're using facing the questions that you use, relatively neutral.
I don't know. I think it was reading other people. I mean, I think Lee Edelman has certainly had an effect in that sense in using that word, and also the whole idea of illegitimacy. I mean, that interests me very much, and of course that just comes from the situation that we're all in. I mean, I think every gay person really does have to. We're being offered, and in a sense, it's very good. I mean, I'm all for. I mean, how can you not be, unless you know, sort of a monster, not to be in favor of the right to marry? I mean, that everyone should have that right if it's something that exists in the society as a right that the majority of the people have. But that's not the same thing as saying, I think the best thing for either gays or straights to aim for is a legitimacy that's already been defined by the culture before you even make any decisions on your own. I mean, there are several, you know, there are all sorts of forms of intimacy that are given to us, as I say in the conversation at one point. And I think there's a connection between forms of intimacy as they've been given to us as intimacy that should be practiced between two people and the way in which we're assumed that we should relate to the state or to other forms of power. And it's that kind of analogy which makes me interested in the idea of examining, you know, that maybe we should, escape the gift that we're so magnanimously being given of, okay, you can finally be as good as we are and get married, you know. Well, I don't want to, you know, it's sort of, and why might one not want to? I mean, I'm putting aside all the very legitimate reasons, and I know you can't put them aside, of having the same, you know, things with legal things, inheritance and so forth, of course. If that's the only way you can have them, then of course there's no choice in a way. But to the extent that one does have a choice, I think it's a choice between defining your relations, intimate and not intimate, in terms that have been given to you as this is the way people love, or this is the way intimacy should take place, or this is the way a citizen should relate to the state. I mean, those things are all, you know, we just take them for granted, but I don't think we should. And certainly, taking them for granted has led to what seems to me, you know, not that improbably, perhaps the end of the world. It's sort of, what could be worse than the state we're in now?
Can we talk a little bit about the death drive? Because it did seem at various points that Bjarne is really seeking to elevate the idea of the death drive in a frankly not terribly sophisticated way as a kind of shattering of the social that is necessarily and inherently liberatory. Is that the way you were sort of reading it as he was?
Well, I think he may see it that way. There have been so many attempts to define what that is that it's, I don't, I'm not sure. I have it right. I don't even know what it means to have it right. But at any rate, what I tend to mean by it is that it's just something that, and this is, I guess, why I find difficult the idea of optimism in queer theory right now. I mean, the most serious reason why I find it difficult, because I think that we should struggle to make relations change, you know, in the micro ways that Foucault, you know, Foucault said two things. We should change new relational modes. Well, that's the huge project, and that takes a lot of thinking to start with, you know, and then action too. But a lot of that remains to be defined. But at the same time, Foucault was always involved very directly in specific causes, in the Palestinian cause, in with prisoners in France especially. So I think, I think those two things, it's not as if we can't do two things at the same time. And, you know, some people have often said, well, you're not paying enough attention to actual political struggles. And I said, well, why not? I mean, I am. And why can't we? I mean, do you have to choose thinking or going out and being in a strike or a parade or in manifestation or so? Why not do both? It's sort of but the thing is, anyway, to get back to your question very quickly, I think the death drive is just, to the extent that there's something destructive, which I really, I mean, if someone could tell me how it could be gotten rid of in a way that would be really persuasive, I'd be very happy about that. But I think even if we have the kind of society that we certainly don't have now, and the kind of society that is peaceful and a good society, a society you want to live in, and you want to do things in and invent things in, I still think that to keep in mind that there may be something intractably negative and destructive in all of us, and that it's part of being born and growing, you know, having to enter the world. The world does not answer all of our desires, you know, and especially the infant, you know, sort of screaming and reaching out and not being able to get what he wants. And we don't lose that entirely. So.
I found very interesting your opposition between what you called the, you know, the gay pastoral and the death drive, which you see as undoing the gay pastoral. And just, I'm struck by the way in which another reading of the death drive would be the cessation of tension, the pursuit of sleep, and thus not made discontinuous at all with the gay pastoral, but in some sense, right, an expression of it.
Well, except even that version of the death drive is much more radical than the pastoral, what I call the pastoral side of the optimism current. Because, you know, what Freud is really talking about in that return to the inanimate is really returning to something like a mineral state. You know, it's sort of the inanimate, the inorganic. On the other hand, there's some interesting work being done, especially by a former student of Kaja's and mine, who now teaches at Princeton, on the life of minerals and animation and the whole idea of the object of objects communicating with us in a kind of dialogue of and the life and of the inorganic. And I mean, it's sort of fascinated me so much, I began to read some cosmological stuff, which is for a whole other life in a way. I mean, it's so difficult, but there's interesting stuff about that. But the death drive, in the other sense, is really returning to the inorganic, not as in our friend's version, potentially alive, but completely dead.
But in Freud, when he introduces the death drive, he still seems to believe in the future, at least maybe through science or other pursuits. And is this how you resist Lee Edelman's position, or do you have another way of not following him as you were mentioning in the film?
Oh, you mean thinking of the future?
Yeah. I mean, is there a meaning for you in the term future?
Well,
I read something so wonderful from Gerhard Richter today about this constant return to hope and our need for it, and he defines it as the consciousness of things to come. The consciousness of things to come that we as human beings cannot manage without the consciousness or the imagination, let's say, of things to come. And that's a very different, that's futural, but it's very different from the kind of future Lee is rejecting.
Exactly, yeah. No, that's, well, that would be my answer, yeah. No, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And I think that, I mean, Kaja and I have really been thinking along parallel lines for many, many years. And I think one of the most profound and for me invigorating aspects of that long dialogue has been that both of us can't live, I mean, as I think most people can't, without some notion of things to come, without some notion of the future, which since, I mean, I don't want to make this something personal about Lee Edelman, but since I know him and like him very much, I feel that he has that too. But he just hasn't gotten around to theorizing.
I think we could take a few, if there is any questions from the audience. We usually open it a bit. We can continue between ourselves, but please, thank you. Anybody? Yes.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Can you?
The question about gay activism, and a kind of perverse one, I think. So let me ask the perverse form of it, and then maybe explain a little bit about why I'm asking it. The question is, the question is, it has to do with your relationship to psychoanalysis, which is obviously a long-standing, ongoing, and very important one, chiefly to the writing of psychoanalysis. But in your latest book, your collaboration with Phillips, you, it seems to me, begin to at least suggest a way in which the practice of psychoanalysis could be taken outside of the consulting room. Outside of the consulting room. That is to say, outside of the strictly analytic dyad, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. In fact, that's, in a way, what you and Phillips are performing or gesturing toward in your conversation in that book. So, you know, the perverse question is, can psychoanalysis be a form of gay activism? The work that you and that all of you have done on the writing of psychoanalysis, it seems to me, is already a kind of activism, right? The distinction between acting and thinking, I think, is, you know, a pretty specious one, right?
Yeah, I know.
Ultimately. But pragmatically, I accept it, right, as we all must. What about the further ways in which someone like you, someone like Adam Phillips, who is himself, of course, a clinician, could take psychoanalysis out of the consulting room and put it to work in something that could be called activism, a socially interventionist form of psychoanalytic practice, and particularly in the service of some sort of pro-queer futurity, right? Is that just
no, that's
beyond the pale.
I can't think of a more central question to be asked about, you know, as a kind of sequel in a certain way to what we were writing about. And I think he's very interested in doing that. And I think I'll just give one example of what I think it involves. It might involve, because there are lots of ways in which this could be taken out of. In other words, his version of how you do an analytic session could be taken out into social interrelations that are outside of the analytic setting. And he's very interested in that. And I think in that book, the first chapter which I wrote deals with a film in which that happens, intimate strangers. And the way in which I saw the relation between the man and the woman in that film, you know, she mistakes a tax lawyer for an analyst. She goes into the wrong door, a woman who's going for her first session with an analyst, and she walks in to this tax lawyer, and she doesn't realize that it's a tax lawyer, and she thinks she's with her analyst. So she says, you know, my life is just terrible, and I'm suffering in an awful way. Well, she's referring to her relations with her husband, but he says, oh, I understand, don't worry. Everybody who comes to me begins by saying that. But that means they owe the IRS money. And so he was thinking, they go through two long meetings not realizing that they're in the wrong room. But when they do, what's fascinating is that they set up more appointments. So this, in a way, is acting out something. I mean, that's the way I see the film, as a possibility. Now, what that might mean actually is that what Adam is very interested in is taking psychoanalysis in the consulting room out of its bias in the direction of knowledge of the other. That the analytic session should not be, in his view, and that's what I find exciting about his thinking, should not be sort of, you know, try to get to that in the unconscious which has been bothering you all these years, and you have to know yourself better. And this is the analytic version of something that goes back, obviously, in our culture to Plato. I mean, and the oracle, I mean, know thyself. So he's really saying, might there be a way of communicating in the analytic session in which the emphasis is not on knowledge of the other, or even the analyst's ends, knowledge of him or herself. And he appeals, there's a few analysts working in this direction. One is Christopher, I can't remember his name.
Bolas,
who talks about analysis as a kind of choreography, where really it's not trying to know anything, but it's trying to catch rhythms, that you're a fundamental rhythm. I mean, Lacan talks about a fundamental fantasy. Bolas would substitute, we each have a fundamental rhythm, and the way is to sort of adjust rhythms. And I mean, what does that mean exactly in an analytic session? But I think this film, they really do, you know, it ends with they get separated, then they start again, they meet again, and it's the idea is they're going to just start being together. It's not sex. And the American critics sort of complained about the film that they never have sex. You know, you're supposed to end up doing that. And the interesting thing is there's no hint that they are going to have sex, but they're going to engage in some kind of what Bolas would actually call some kind of dance with each other. And I think that can be taken very easily out of in intimacy. Why do we always assume that when we, you know, love someone else, that the primary thing is, you know, the complaint that people often make, well, you never make any effort to know who I am. Well, that's usually taken as a criticism. But what if it might be said as, you know, oh, it's so wonderful, you never make any attempt to know who I am. You know, it's there are a lot of possibilities in that. And that would certainly be a mode, a very important one, of taking out of the analytic room into other contexts. But there's a lot, I mean, that's a really important question, and there's a lot of thinking and acting to do in that direction, I think.
Thank you.
I have a question about how the language of criticism can be mobilized to engage the violence that you discuss as being inherent in all of us. And I'm asking it in the particular context of this film and the way that it invokes three theorists, yourself and Lee Edelman and Tim Dean, who all perform in some of their texts a certain kind of what might be read as an aggressive mode of writing or a mode of writing that enacts a certain kind of refusal and a negation. But then in the case of your work with Adam Phillips and this film, but also I think in Tim Dean's later work, there's a shift in tone to a different, more intimate way of engaging those same questions, and one that is more responsive to the critiques of those questions and that is more willing to go back and forth. And I wondered if you could say something both about the different kinds of possibilities that are opened up between, for example, writing The Culture of Redemption or Homos and doing intimacies with Adam Phillips, but also the differences in doing a dialogue in a text form or on film.
Yeah, that's... I don't know. I always sort of hesitate a little to think too much about how I'm writing. I mean, I sort of feel that I'll lose it if I think too much about it. But there's a way in which I think that maybe most people, when they begin to write, and certainly I know that most graduate students are forced into writing with a terrible degree of seriousness, and not too aggressive, but very serious and very earnest. Then maybe it seemed to me that, or at least seemed to me, I'll give you my trajectory since you're in. Then you get to the point, the early, at least the first stuff that I've written, I just felt, you know, I could just be a little more aggressive, but still just as serious. And then it seemed to me that, and I guess Homos, I mean, I'll give an example of this. The pages in Homos that I can't remember most of it, but pages that I like the best are the first two or three pages of the chapter called The Gay Daddy. And it's about my relation to Foucault and about how I think he was crazy when he said that the thing that straight people object to when they see two gay men holding hands in the Castro is not images of gay sex, but is that they see happiness and they can't stand the idea that we're happier than they are. Well, I think that's naive. But at the same time, it fascinates me. So in those two or three pages, I when I had to reread them at some point, I thought, God, that's very perverse and playful, and that interests me. I mean, I think there's a way of being a little elusive in your writing, and not... I came across this thing... I mean, the only way I can read Lacan, unlike Kaja, who really understands him, but the only way...
Jean-Michel.
The only way I can read Lacan is every once in a while a sentence hits me, and which I think is wonderful, and I'm not sure how it connects to anything else. But anyway, at some point, he's talking to the to the group in one of the seminars and saying, if there's one thing the one thing that I want you to know, and of course he said this about many other things, but in this case, it's the one thing I want you to know is to never take yourself seriously. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's the whole sort of clown side of Lacan, which I think is quite marvelous. You know, it's what a breath of fresh air in psychoanalysts. But, you know, you read psychoanalytic writing. So, I don't know, I think there's a way in which I certainly don't use him as a model for for a type of writing, but there is some way in which somebody used the word irony at some point. I think we can be ironic about what we also are taking very seriously. But there's a way of taking oneself, I don't know, there's a way of being serious and a way of taking oneself seriously. I guess that's the difference. And I want to be serious, but I would hope that
you
I
are serious, Leo. You are very serious.
Pardon me?
You are serious, and there is a great moment in the film where you don't take yourself seriously, and that's when you start to say, "I don't defend terrorism."
And then says, "And nobody cares what I think." Yeah.
Well, especially about that question.
Yes. Yeah.
It's the ridiculousness of finding oneself saying, but of course I don't support terrorism.
But I have a question here about, let's say, the antithesis, the opposite of being didactic, ponderous, serious, a teacher. What is it? Is it art? Are you, because I'm thinking of the context of the production of this film, the Venice Biennale, and the way it was shown and discussed. Where do you see yourself moving in that direction? In something art, like art today, or a different sense of art, that means?
I mean, that's the trouble. I'm not sure what art means. The only thing I'm sure about is that there, and this, I guess, was the greatest thing I got from my reading of Beckett, which was that there, if there is something called art, it's not the same thing as culture. Culture is what we take seriously, or what officially is taken seriously. The great history of culture, the great, it's mainly in the United States, the conservatives who several years ago when, in the Department of Education under Reagan, who wanted everybody to begin reading great books again. Yeah. That was, you know who I'm talking about.
I don't, I can't remember the idiot's name. Yeah.
At any rate, he had a great deal of influence. The idea was that, that our culture will make you better, and that therefore students should be exposed to the great books of our culture because it'll make them what? I mean, in this man's mind, it was a very conservative mind, but I think he was very smart in the sense that he realized if you thought of books as making you morally better, he meant that would make you a better and implicitly, I read it, as more obedient citizen. And that you were more better integrated. Whereas I think the great thing about so-called art, when it's not taken as cultural monument, is that it's extremely against conformity in a certain way. I mean, it's sort of, how can anyone read Shakespeare's tragedies and say that, that you learn anything in the sense that this guy wanted us to learn from or Oedipus Rex, or any great, and Beckett is the marvelous example in modern literature. I mean, Beckett sees, his view of culture is just marvelously black, and with that sort of devastating humor too. And the idea of, the giving him the Nobel Prize and his sort of not even responding is sort of what's that? And that's the sort of, it seems to me to make some sense for a biologist or something, but for a writer to go in and be part of this official, now I'm culture. Whereas I think if there's something that is art, it's anti-culture.
And disorderly in the way that this film really was. And
even works of great order. I think French 17th century tragedy, which could hardly be more ordered in its form, is at the same time, Racine is just a, there's not a single line that doesn't have 12 syllables, but at the same time, it's, and the rhyme, the whole thing, but at the same time, it's just massive disorder and violence and chaos, and that's the greatness. Stuffed into the Alexander.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.